The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 12th of March, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Peter Bird, Chief Executive Officer of Asia Met Resources. That's ARS ticker. And Peter discusses their progress on their BKM project in Indonesia and the copper market. Also on the podcast, Paul Haywood, Chief Executive Officer of Block Energy, BLOE. And Paul talks about their operational progress in Georgia and quashes financing rumours. Plus, Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications, talks about the following companies. We briefly mentioned i3 Energy because the RNS came out when we were chatting. Grand Vision Media Holdings, Avivo and Tuple. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, you can see both these lists, in fact, top 10 versions of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll also see a swathe, a veritable bag of content there on lots of things, from Bluebird Merchant Ventures to SP Angels Morning View about US-China trade hopes and Brexit deal optimism. I think that's been quashed at the moment, though, or dampened down. Bacanora Lithium and Gritland Gold from Zach there, Zach Mia. There's lots of stuff there. It's voxmarkets.co.uk.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Peter Bird, Chief Executive Officer of Asia Met Resources, ARS's ticker. Peter, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Justin. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, and I take it you have even better weather over there than we are having over here. It's a storm situation over here.
Yeah. Well, we're on the other end of the seasons, aren't we? We're moving into our cooler weather.
Oh, nice. So it's been too hot for you. We're longing for some sun. before we go, I mean, there's been lots of news coming from Asia Met in the last few weeks, and so we have to catch up on that, and we'll also catch up on the copper market, which is all important, of course. Before we do, if someone is tuning in right now and listening and they're not quite familiar with Asia Met, can you give a quick summary as to what you're all about, please, Peter?
Yeah, sure. So Asia Met's an AIM-listed copper-focused resource company focused in Indonesia, in the Pacific. We currently have 2.4 million tonnes or 5.3 billion pounds of copper in resource, plus about 1.6 million ounces of gold. And we're capped at circa US $100 million. Our inventory is sort of spread over a portfolio of assets, which I can talk about a bit later, located both in Kalimantan and Aceh in Indonesian archipelago.
Yeah, and the focus at the moment, of course, is the BKM project. You're in the middle of a sort of feasibility study, I think, in the middle. If you had to put a percentage on it, What percentage would you say you are of completing it at the moment?
We said in the late part of last year that we had about a 4 to 6 month time horizon from mobilisation. So we're well into that period now. So we would hope late April, early May, we would be getting close to being done.
Okay, and you've just received key approvals from Indonesia. Can you take us through the significance of these and what they are, please?
Yeah, sure. So BKM is the most advanced asset in our portfolio. So for listeners, it's a solvent extraction, electrowinning copper project, which is in the advanced stages of a bankable feasibility, as we just touched on. And the recent work includes an infill drilling program, which was some geology and geotech. That work is now complete, and we're working on the evaluation of that information. And it's actually just for interest surrounded by an additional 31 projects, which also need following up. So it's a very exciting area within the contract of work. The point you're referring to is, as part of the feasibility process, we've been progressively working through the in-country permitting process, which is a normal and sequential process, with two of our key permits, which we were seeking in 2019, being what's called the Indonesian Feasibility or Government Document Sign-Off, and full environmental approval. So we announced last week that both of these have been approved, and pretty much with respect to the government document, very much on time. But the environmental approval was well ahead of our original schedule. So the next, and there's a whole sequence of permits that we have to go through as we advance, some minor, some major. But the next major one to look out for will be effectively the full go-ahead, or what's called a borrow and use permit. But that's not anticipated until late this calendar year or early next. So it's all progressing very much to our schedule.
Yeah, so is that what the production permit, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So that'll be in the latter, I would say, either the very end of this calendar year or the early part of next, which is very much our schedule.
Yeah, okay. Well, listen, you're obviously in a jurisdiction that's and your project's being welcomed by the government authorities there. And let's talk about the actual asset itself, the commodity of copper, because it's one of the hottest, and you know, predicted to be the hottest in the next few to 5-10 years at least, with the EV market coming online and getting you know, bigger and better. And and I can't see at the moment why copper's taking a hit, because you know, everyone. I mean, you'd think it'd be rallying rampantly, wouldn't you? But what's the deal here? What's your thoughts on copper at the market, Peter?
Yeah, Justin, if you could indulge me, I think I was sort of contemplating this a little bit today, but here's some sort of fast facts which I can just expand upon a little, but let's get the 3 points across first. With respect to the copper market, we are supply-side constrained for the forward-looking projections right out to 2026, 2027. So that's the first issue. The second issue is that the copper price, as with many other base metals, has been in decline since around 2011, 2012, with a recent directional shift. So the forward-looking pricing is very positive, and I'll come back to that. We are now saying, related to that, the bull run or the upward part of the cycle has now begun. And for a metal which you just touched upon has so many traditional and alternative energy uses, there's very limited ways to play the commodity in the listed space outside the super majors. So if I sort of just expand upon each one of those points. Mm-hmm. On the supply constrained side, both Wood Mackenzie and S&P Global data suggests that copper consumption will rise steadily from the current levels of 22 to 23 million tonnes per annum to around 27 million tonnes per annum by 2027. So that's the first point. It's continually rising. On top of and that's on top of both traditional demand and what I call new green demand, which is things like electric vehicles and renewables. And EVs, for example, the consumption in that same period is meant to rise about tenfold. But here's the catch. To meet that 27 million tonne level by 2027, an estimated $184 billion is required to be invested both in capital and on the exploration production stages of the supply side. And only $44 billion or 24% is committed as we sit here today. So it's supply constrained and will continue to be so. So that's sort of, if you like, green flag one. Mm-hmm. The second one, which is obviously intimately related, is the copper price. So in 2011-12, the copper price topped out at above US $4.50 a pound, and then it steadily declined into early 2016-17 and sort of got down to the low $2 a pound level. Through 2018, the supply demand balance started to play out with a shift, but as you just referenced, there's been some shorter term bumps in the marketplace, and I think there, and I say shorter term, things like Brexit in the UK and the trade wars certainly had an impact late last calendar year. But since then and into this new year that we're now in, we've seen it rebound. Now, the people smarter than me are projecting that, like Wood Mac, are projecting that the copper price by in the next 2 years will move forward up to $3.85 per pound from the current levels of the high two. So that's quite a shift, and it's still well below that $4.50 level in the last cycle. So that's green flag two. I think the other thing to think about, the third point, is that it's a cyclical commodity. So available capital and the ebb and flow of metal supply results in commodities oscillating in a bit of a sine wave about a midpoint. And we've seen that over generations. In the case of copper, consumption has and continues to grow at a little over 2% per annum, and that's occurred since the 1950s. But as highlighted in my previous two points, we're moving into a strong upcycle, and there's very little in the way of new projects that have been discovered or advanced since that peak cycle in 2011-12. Now, in 2011-12, there was $890 million spent in sort of exploring and developing assets. And if we contrast that with only $190 million spent in 2017, so, you know, it's a paltry amount. And if you take that a step further, if we strip out two of the biggest sort of discoveries or stories, which was Nevsun's Timok copper project in Europe, which has recently been taken over by Zijin, and of course SolGold's Cascabel project, the balance of the spend has been paltry. There's been nothing spent. So that's green flag three. There has just been no money spent, but there's all of a sudden, and there's supply side constraint, and demand is about to pick up. So we've got three green flags. We're sort of, if you like, off to the races all of a sudden. So there's very few ways to play the copper cycle outside of the super majors, which everyone has in their portfolio, and what I call the mature mid caps. So then if you start looking around a little bit, and companies like AsiaMet is in an excellent position because it's already got a portfolio that it put together in the down cycle of 5.3 billion pounds of copper in resource. We have great people who've done this before, and the timing is excellent. And really, the other juniors will be a bit slower to the table simply because there hasn't been the capital available to allow them to explore. So I think that's the way I see the marketplace at the minute, and I think we're exceptionally well positioned.
Yeah, and I suppose, yeah, like you say, there's short to mid-term worries about the global growth, and there's a bit of a slowdown happening, but that's temporary. It's temporary, isn't it? And let's be honest, even when you say, you know, China, they say they've gone from a hard sort of expansion of 6.5% GDP down now to 6 to 6.5. Even that, though, their conversion into EVs will still impact the market massively, surely.
Yeah, that's right. And if you think of China, that's a good point to raise. China consumes a little over 40% of the global copper market, and it's still growing at circa 6%. And that's contrast with the global average of, I think, 3.2 or thereabouts, 3.3%. So it's still a very, very strong economy, and will be a big part of that 27 million tonnes I'm referring to out to 2027. So I think things like, the Brexit issues and the trade war issues, which have defined dates to be resolved, and once they're resolved and everyone knows the outcome and therefore the direction, I think the market will stabilise and focus on the raw fundamentals, which is the supply-demand issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So in actual fact, you know, some of these worries, yeah, cloud the longer-term trend, don't they? And in fact, it's probably an opportunity, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really, because we think in years, not in weeks. Mm-hmm. It's, without being disrespectful, it's white noise because those things will pass, but the fundamentals of the fact that not enough capital has been invested but demand continues to grow steadily will throw us into a period of, you know, very aggressive pricing, I think, because there's no new product, as I've referred to, or not enough product coming onto the bat for consumers, and that's going to create a squeeze.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? Your uptick in your share price of late is not unsimilar to the coppers at the moment, is it?
No, it's not. And I think I don't think, unfortunately, we were not unique just prior to Christmas. I think, you know, a lot of commodity stocks were hit quite dramatically as a result of the issues we talked about, the shorter term issues. But the fundamentals of those companies, including ourselves, have not changed. So I think we're seeing a reversion in our pricing back up to sort of probably where it should be. Or I mean, I've clearly been the CEO, I think there's probably a lot more value in it than's currently represented. And that's simply just doing some simple metrics on the inventory we have and the quality of the inventory. But I'm not surprised that the price has improved.
Okay, excellent stuff, Peter. Well, one final thing to do. If someone's listening to this right now, likes the sound of the progress you're making, the commodity you're in, but are not following the story, please give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, Justin, as I said, it's a very exciting time to be involved in copper. As a commodity, it has base load, it's a renewable, and it's very difficult to substitute. And a company like AsiaMet offers you excellent exposure to that marketplace.
Good stuff, Peter. Hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin. Hopefully that went okay.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Heywood, Chief Executive Officer of Block Energy, BLOE. His ticker. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Justin. Thanks for having me.
And where are you at the moment? Are you in Georgia? Are you back home? Where are you at the moment? What are you doing?
I am back in London for the next few days. I'm off to Georgia early next week. So, yeah. It's pretty windy over here at the moment, but all good. It's nice to be home.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, before we catch up on news, what's been happening, the progress you're making out there, just a quick summary of the business for people not that familiar with Block Energy, please, Paul.
Of course, yeah, yeah. So we're an E&P company having listed on the AIM market back in June 2008, raised £5 million, and we're currently working through multiple work programs across our asset base. We're a party to three production sharing contracts. We are the operator. We're 100% in one license, moving to 100% in another, and 90% in our third license.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, well, let's go back to the news. And let's go back, when was this? 4th of March. Let's clear up something, because there were some rumours flying around, and you issued some equity for around $70,000, and some people said that that could have been a placing, and you needed money, and that was what you were raising. Now, could you just clear this up, please?
Yes, of course. That's a question I'm being hit with. It's a question that's on a lot of people's lips right now, that's for sure. Just to be clear, look, that equity issue was purely settlement of contracts entered into by the company back in 2018, primarily for services, actually. I mean, yeah. Being extremely frank here, Justin, we like to ensure that all department heads are tightly aligned with the executive team and its shareholder and the company shareholders. And for that, or in doing so, the way in which we like to structure compensation typically includes a form of equity, so that if the such key departments perform, then you know, hopefully that feeds through to additional value at the company level, at shareholder level, and therefore certain individuals get to share in the upside of equity. So that was kind of part of the reason that we issued that equity back several weeks back, and in parallel to some contractual obligations whereby settlement terms included some of the company's equity as part of a contract that was entered into back in 2018. So have we gone out into the market to raise £70,000? Absolutely not. Am I currently running around the market raising more money? Absolutely not. The company is absolutely focused on executing its current program in 16A and advancing its program in Norio, and looking very forward to the to the results that could well come of current operations. So yeah.
Okay, so it wasn't a tiny raise in any way, and you're not looking to raise money, so that's good. Let's clear that up. So let's go on to operational progress, if we can. And so you announced, you know, increased production rates at the Norio field recently. So what's going on? Where are you up to? And let's also explain where you hope to get, Paul, if you could.
Yeah, sure. Look, Justin, as you're aware, and I'm sure our followers are aware, we've been trying some new things in Norio, and Norio's always been a slow and steady oil enhancement kind of project for us, whereby, you know, the netbacks in Norio are significant due to the fact that we've got we've got some pretty enhanced fiscal terms under the Norio PSC, whereby we get to recover 100% of our OPEX before sharing any oil with the state. That really does enhance the company's netbacks on each barrel produced. So we don't have to produce much in Norio for Norio to A, be profitable and kind of meet our payback thresholds on any desired work program, which typically, if we're deploying capital in Norio, we want to make sure that we see a return within 12 months, and the current program is now on track to do exactly that. And also, you know, the company's break-even production rate is kind of in and around $100 barrels a day at $60 Brent. So, we've currently increased production in Norio by four times from bringing two wells online. That's well 27 and 44. We got a third well coming online shortly that we hope will add to current production. We're at 60 barrels of oil a day. The read across there in terms of annual revenue is about $1.1 million a year for us. That's free cash from the 60 barrels of oil a day. So, you know, these numbers aren't groundbreaking, and they're not going to set the market alight. But what it does do is it gives the company, you know, a financial backbone and enables it to be somewhat self-sustaining. So that's what the Norio program is all about. We've proven this new technology in two wells, and it's worked fantastically well for us in that the production rates that have been achieved to date are well above our base case forecast. So, although, again, it's 60 barrels a day is not going to set the world on fire. It's kind of giving us what we need from the Norio program.
Yeah, well, of course, and it's cutting down on costs, and you're like 60% of the way to breaking even. So how long do you think it'll take to get there, and what is the ultimate target here then, Paul?
So the plan for Norio was 250 barrels a day. There's a larger well that we are planning to drill in Norio, and that's a sidetrack of an existing well, which is forecast to give us around 100 barrels a day, which obviously adds to existing production significantly. Although in saying that, given the recent results from the current workover program, you know, there are some additional candidates that we think would perform extremely well for us. So we're going to carry on with using the tool source from North America, get some more results from working simple workovers of these wells, whilst in parallel completing what is a high impact program in West Vestavia. I guess we'll get onto that shortly.
Yeah. And Mars, so as far as you're concerned here, Paul, are you happy with the progress you're making at the moment?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Norio's taken a little bit longer than expected. These things often do. You know, we had to make sure that we completely cleared the way on these workover candidates to ensure that we could use the tool in the right way. And the extra time spent on cleaning up these wellbores and making sure that the downhole situation was fit for purpose was extremely important. And that's complemented the kind of results that we're seeing back now out of the existing wells.
Yes, and so let's look at down the line there. Look further down the line, six months, 12 months, 18 months, where do you hope to be?
Yeah, in Norio, at least, we'd definitely like to perform some additional workovers and get this, potentially look at executing this horizontal sidetrack of Norio 60 that's already been prepared. So we'd like to see ourselves up at around 250 barrels a day in Norio, and then take a view on the broader development program. Given we've now moved, or we're in the process of moving to 100% in West Vestavia, the reservoir we're chasing West Vestavia has historically proven to be far more productive than that in Norio. So, you know, when you're making an investment decision, Justin, as I'm sure you're aware, you typically kind of map out your returns against multiple plays, and you say, well, where am I going to get the best bang for my buck? And right now, given the current terms associated with our position in West Vestavia, we expect dollars spent in West Vestavia to be as productive, if not more productive, than dollars spent in Norio. So Norio has always been a slow incremental build for us to get us above our break-even rate. And then we'll stand back and take a view on what to do further. But right now, you know, a lot of the companies and resources and attention is focused on getting this significant well done in West Rastavi and mapping out a broader development program now that we are in control of our destiny.
Marvellous stuff. Well, Paul, as always, if someone is listening right now and likes the progress you're making there but not following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
First and foremost, we are two-thirds of the way through our most important well right now in West Rastavi. This is by far the most high-impact program within the current the company's current portfolio. We have passed the most critical stages of executing that well and are now drilling horizontally. I'd definitely say that's one to keep an eye on for the market. The company's interims are due to be released at the end of this month. I would urge all of our followers to take a close look at those numbers. I think the interims will make an interesting read for the market. And, you know, the broader development program, there is lots going on for us in Georgia right now. And I think the strengthened position in West Rastavi, the good interim results from Norio kind of lead to, you know, us being one to follow. I think that's your three, Justin.
Marvellous stuff, Paul. Good to chat to you. And like I said, lots going on there. So no doubt we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications. You all
right, Al? I'm fine, Jess. Weather's taking a turn for the worse. It's probably...
It's Brexit-related. It's Brexit. Is it all Brexit-related?
It's Brexit-related, yeah. You know, you look out the window, it's depressing, windy and wind and rain and God knows what else, and then you think, oh, Theresa May's got her vote this afternoon, so everyone's feeling the same way. Gloomy, I think, is the word, so...
Yeah, I wonder how... I can't see getting through, can you, from 230 down to... we're edging closer to... I just said it'll be delayed anyway now because you won't be able to get all the administration points through in time. So there's going to be a delay anyway. So I think that delay plays into the hands of, Remainers. And that means, I think, Brexiteers will not want a delay, do they? So I think they should get support there. It'd be interesting to see how much she gets support on that deal, you know?
I think she should get more support. But as you say, even if she passes it from an administrative standpoint, they're going to have to delay it anyway because they simply won't get the I's dotted and the T's crossed in time. And, you know, it's just... I think the whole country is just so heartily sick of the whole process because there's been it's a poison chalice. She was handed a poison chalice when she came to office, but I don't think she's been decisive in the way she's handled it at all. But when you look around at who else is there to pick up to pick up the reins and take it forward, there's just a dearth there's almost a vacuum of power. There's nobody there with the charisma and the bottle to actually take this forward and you know, impress what we want on the EU. But there we go. We are where we are.
By the way, I just said, but this is good to have the Vox Markets app. So do you still own i3 Energy? They just raised £16 million minimum at 37 pence.
I do, yeah. Well, I bought and sold and bought and sold. I had a very that's been one of my best stocks in over the past few years. Actually, I initially bought it at 22p and sold a block off at £1.25 when it rose up last year. So they've just raised money at 37p, which is good. You know, that's a proposed placing to raise 16 million. I can see this here. That kind of puts a floor under it, and they'll be plugging into a producing field, or it's adjacent to a producing field with most of the infrastructure in place. So that's it's a pretty exciting development. You know, it could, I think i3 will come on, you know, once they have the infrastructure in place there, it'll come on stream very quickly indeed.
Exactly. They've got a bit of churn there first, but they've got some cash. That's good. That's the same as their market cap. That's unbelievable. So...
I know. But there were concerns over funding, so I would expect now that that we'll see a rapid increase in the share price. In fact, let's just have a look and see what's happening right now. Well, it's dropped down to the raised price from 43p open this morning, so no surprise there. But you know, there's a floor there now, and I would expect us to progress from here. But yes, shares can go down as well as up. Don't forget, as we keep on saying.
Yeah, marvelous. Okay, so what are we looking at, Al? What stocks are you looking at? Here?
First company, so I'm looking at, four stocks, GVMH, Grand Vision Media Holdings. GVMH is the epic code. HVivo, which is a life sciences company, HVO, the epic code. Telecoms Group Tuple, Tuple is the epic code. And also, I want to just revisit quickly Salt Lake Potash, which we did discuss recently, but there was a significant development there last week. And, of course, you had Joe Battersill from the company on the podcast too. First things first, GVMH, Grand Vision Media Holdings. Now, this is a company that was founded in Hong Kong in 2014, and it raised $1 million in June 2018. There was a reversal into Simeon Mobile, I believe it was the previous company. So GVMH provide 3D glasses free technology. These are advertising panels which appear in cinema foyers, shopping malls, and cinemas, and they're very much first movers in this area. The digital outdoor signage market is huge. It was worth globally some $15 billion in 2015 and is expected to rise to $30 billion in 2024. And you've got companies such as JC Deco, which everyone knows. You'll see their screens all over the place. And in China, you've got companies like Clear Media. GVMH have launched a series of advertising panels. They've got panels at over 180 locations in China, which is currently less than 5% of the market. But they have a fully interactive solution in that if you walk into a cinema and you like what you see on the screen, you can grab the barcode or the iPhone code or whatever that pattern is, and you can actually log your details from that with the advertiser, and they can then get in touch with you, the message can then be plugged into their e-commerce system and their digital marketing system. So it's a complete one-stop shop in that regard. Said at the end of last year it would be expanding quite rapidly during the year. There was a broker note out in January from TS Capital, which looked at the developments in the company developments, and it forecast an EBITDA of just over $1 million sterling for full year 2019, which on a price earnings multiple of 22 equated to a price of 25p. Stock's currently trading at 16.5p with a valuation of $16 million. So that's not too ambitious a target. But already we've seen in 2019 the company has increased its footprint. It signed an agreement with Daddy Cinema Group, which is a big cinema group in China, with an additional 22 new cinemas across their network. One of the big opportunities for GVMH is the the Chinese audience who A, love cinemas, but also they love to travel they make up a large percentage of the tourist visitors into both Japan and Korea. And to that end, GVMH then announced at the end of January an arrangement with CY Group in Korea, and the CY Group are acting as an introducer for GVMH into the Korean cinema networks, and they've already set up a pilot for GVMH in Korea. They then announced a deal with Rakuten Bank, which owns the WeChat app in across Japan. It's a big tourist destination for Chinese tourists, and Recruitment Bank are acting as an agent introducer for GVMH in Japan, and they've already they are already now providing services that is 3D signage boards at Narita Airport. So if you go to Narita Airport in Japan, you'll see the boards there. So it's a company that's growing. It's expected to sign more deals this year. It's already done that. We have a forecast of 25 pence per share going forward. So one to watch, an interesting space, and no doubt as the company expands into this a huge potential global marketplace, we're going to hear a lot more about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't really understand it really.
Well, having to go to the cinema and put on your 3D glasses to look at a sign, when you walk into the cinema foyer, you'll see a screen and stuff will literally jump out of you. I've actually seen one of these screens, and it's quite impressive. So the Chinese are massive cinema goers; they love the cinema, and it's so you've got a great opportunity to grab their attention as they walk into the foyer, and with the digital interaction that the boards offer, it's a real growth marketplace, and China obviously being as huge as it is, there's a huge opportunity to reach and to do business with other cinema groups across China, and that's exactly what GVMH are engaged in right now.
Yeah, I just want to see more results. You know, I want to see how they're progressing financially before I'd because it's always you know brokers will obviously be bullish one day on their stocks, but you know, I want to see what's happening, you know, underneath the hood there. Anyway, let's move on. What's next, Al?
Okay, we spoke about life sciences company HVO at the start of the year. The stock is currently worth £22 million, been as high as just over £1 on the year, and as low as 15.5p. Currently trading at 25.5p, and the stock hasn't really moved a great deal, but there have been some interesting developments here. So HVO are a life sciences company, and they run a series of pioneering technology platforms where they test human disease models to accelerate drug discovery and delivery. The company are well funded. They have 10 million cash in the bank with a 2.5 million R&D grant as well. When Trevor Phillips is well regarded in the industry, he is the chairman of the company, and he said that with the last statement that they anticipate a massively improved full year outcome for 2019, and the reason I wanted to bring this up now is because they are announcing these results on the 11th of April, so we're just under a month away, and it's often a good time if you're considering buying a stock to look at this, and you can maybe speculate on the back of the results and the run of the results, or you might want to wait until after the results and then buy in after that. Nonetheless, Trevor Phillips said the costs have been reduced. They expect to generate 9 million in revenues from quarter four 2019. And where the company now has a market cap of 20 million, Trevor is his ambition is to take the company back to where it was a year or so ago with a market cap of 100 million. So how are they going to do that? Their flagship model is the flu vaccine, and they're running this as a joint venture with Immutex, another company in the space, exploring a number of strategic options. But they had a series of positive test results back from NIAID, which is the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, who've been running tests across the flu platform. They noted a highly significant reduction in primary endpoints for mild to moderate flu, and the test proved that the vaccines had a protective effect and is achieving levels of clinical efficacy, and the flu vaccine is now ready for phase three, which is the final phase in it. So the company's at an interesting juncture right now, just off year lows, in the run up to full year results, and a very positive clinical test results from NIAID last month. So again, As an investor, you might want to wait and see what comes up with the results. But the company, to me, gives the impression of being on the launch pad. And you know, once the flu V virus gets past phase three and out into production, then, you know, we could see this company explode into action and maybe achieve Trevor Phillips' ambition of getting the company back to 100 million market cap. But do your own research.
Yeah, do you know what? On the weekend podcast, I did sort of five ways to, let's say, basically to avoid risk and you know, increase the chance of success, and it's about avoiding known risk, you know. And a couple of times I fell and fall of this one of jumping in before results, because I think, yes, do you know what? Yep. You are speculating, and the risk is higher there. And it always pays off just to wait. Always. You may have, if the results come out and they're decent, good, that confirms, then let the spike come down, let it calm down, and then buy in. Then a lot of risk is gone. You know, the risk is gone then because you've got confirmation in the results. If you jump in beforehand, okay, you make a nice jump up on the results, but say, do you know what? So often, results don't exceed. They often, you know, average or less than expectations. This is always good to get. And also, once you're in and it drops on bad results, you can't get out. Or you can, you know, if you do try and get out, you're at a massive discount. So I just think, if you want to reduce risk, just wait for results. Be patient. Yeah. And I've done it so many times. I've done it now recently with Metro Bank. I jumped in there for a punt and it hasn't worked. I'm 10% down. And I'm going, why don't you just wait until they've raised these funds? They're raising funds via placing. And you know, it's like they haven't done it yet, and that's sort of the level of where they're doing it is just playing on the share price. I said, why did I just wait? It was never going to take off and go gangbusters anyway, and if it did, it always comes back. So I just think, always wait. You know, it's different. Like I said, it's the difference between investing, in my mind, and gambling. You know,
very much so. Well, I think there are strategies both for traders and for investors there. If you're an investor, yes, wait until after the results, you know, because you're looking to take a long-term view because you like what the product does. If you're a trader, you might want to use the run-up to results and the positive clinical trial results as an opportunity to trade the stock and take a ride on the speculation that might take the share price higher, and then you sell out maybe before the results. There's an old saying in the markets, it's better to travel than to arrive. So you might want to take that view if you're a trader. But if you're an investor, yes, I agree totally. I think wait until after the results, for sure.
Yeah, that was a stock there was very much a hot thing of a couple of months ago. And do you know what? It reminds me of, at the moment, Proactis is the same. A lot of people mention Proactis on Twitter. And I just think this a turnaround takes a lot longer than you think. Always. There's always that thing of, you know, profit warnings come in threes. I mean, it does, literally. Again, you can wait. It does take a heck of a long time. A turnaround does take a long time. And it doesn't wash out within a couple of months. It takes, you know, six months to a year to 18 months, more like. So I just think, you know, always have a wait. It's patience, as we know. Mr. Buffett always says patience pays off. He's right.
You're right there. Yep.
What next, Al? What's with gentleman next?
Okay, this is another company that's in the run-up to results and the AGM on March the 22nd, which is, so we're literally about 10, 12 days away. We spoke about this again in early February. Tuple, T-O-O-P is the Epic code, and this is a company that provides telecom services to the UK SME market. The company raised $2.2 million in December, and at that stage, the CEO, Andy Hollingsworth, said he expected that raise to fund the company through to profitability. So possibly, probably even, the company will not need to raise any more money because it will then become self-funding. Which as a small company, that's utopia. That's what everyone would ideally like to have in their portfolio. So how the company done so far? They signed a $3.5 million contract with a major new wholesaler in February 2019. They've got nine new partner agreements with UK third parties going forward through the year. As I said, already said, when they run up to the interims, currently 20% of orders, repeat orders, are coming from existing customers. We said beforehand they have been very quiet since the last announcement regarding the contract, but again, We are in the run-up to the results next week. If you're a potential investor in Tuple, do you wait and sit on your hands? If you're an investor, you might well do. They have the AGM on March the 22nd as well. Or as a trader, do you look at this tiny company, think, well, they raised $2.2 million, they've got a $3.5 million contract in the bag already this year, and they've got a market cap of $2.77 million. Is there upside from here in the run-up to the results? If you're a trader, you might want to take that view. But nonetheless, this is a great little niche company, and I think if Tuple grow and then they fund their own growth organically through their own revenues, then they would become very attractive to one of the bigger players in the sector. So that's the update there.
Yeah, I've done some updates on Tuple, and it's been quite good. And Andy's come on and said they've broken records, and the business seems to be going the right way. The only concern I've had, listen, I've reduced my exposure to equities across my entire portfolio. I'm now at 64% cash. I do believe we're going in for a sticky year, and I think, and the reason why I do that is because I want cash to take advantage of opportunities. Yep. I want lots of it, and I've been concerned that Tuple haven't released anything since December the 18th, which was their final results. Normally, every month they've been updating the market, and so I've reduced my positions across all the board anyway, but and Tuple as well. Because I just think we should have had some kind of update by now, which is all going well, of course. No reason to suspect. I mean, 3 months is a quarter. Sometimes we expect too much news. But, I just think in this market where I'm very cautious at the moment, I've reduced size, yeah.
I think across the board, and I think if you speak to anyone in business at any level, the first 3 months, quarter one this year, has been pretty quiet because of Brexit, and I speak to so many people, and I'm getting the same message all the time. It is very quiet. A lot of companies are waiting to see what happens, and contracts that might be signed are being delayed because of that. So totally understandable. It doesn't mean to say that the business model is poor or is going to be impacted, but clearly, let's hope Theresa pulls a rabbit out of the hat this afternoon. But there we go.
Who knows? What's your take on Theresa May, Al? Do you think she's some people say the worst prime minister we've ever had?
Well, I said at the start she was handed a poison chalice, but when somebody who for kicks runs through fields of corn, and that's kind of the high point of her life, I just think she probably needs to live a little more. And I don't know. I think she's very determined. I think she's very well meaning, but I don't. I think when you're the leader of a country, you've got to have charisma. You've got to have something about you. And everyone now hates Tony Blair, but he had bags of charisma when he was in office before WMD. Maggie Thatcher, obviously, years ago. David Cameron, he had something, and then he handed the referendum vote to the country. But I'm not going to go into that. But all of these leaders have something on the international stage, and you can put them anywhere, and they're going to give their best, and they're charismatic, and people like them. Theresa May, I think people fundamentally find her a bit dull and boring, and that comes across when she goes to the EU. Having said that, Angela Merkel's joyful. Vivacious female issue. So maybe I've got that one wrong, but that's just my view.
Yeah, no, I know. Do you know what? Part of me thinks but the thing that's annoying about her is the thing that she champions is her strength, and that's just hanging on, and going through the pressure and hanging on there under lots of pressure. But let's be honest, she's a lady that, sat on the reduction in the police forces and cut that back massively. And yeah, some people say it's that what you reap of what you sow, and so we've seen issues around policing and all that stuff. So
I mean, the knife crime issue is very serious, it's a phase and a trend, and probably as a result of social media, it's just this the gang mentality where youngsters feel they have to prove themselves. And when you haven't got community policemen walking around, then there's little disincentive. The youngsters feel they can carry a knife with impunity, and they won't get picked up. So it's it is worrying, it is concerning. But I think this is where perhaps neighbourhood watches have to come in, and all the rest of it. But It does seem to be the focal points do seem to be city centres, but you know, I'm on the south coast here, and I heard yesterday someone in Eastbourne that there was an issue with a load of lads carrying knives around in Eastbourne, and you think, my goodness, if it's happening in Eastbourne, could happen anywhere.
Yeah, we've slipped into politics there. Actually, you studied it. But there we are. You know, sometimes finance and politics intertwine. I think the Brexit thing is massive there. I think, do you know what? I think we'll have a sell-off. I don't think it'll pass. I think we'll have a sell-off tomorrow morning and a bit more volatility until they get through again. I think the last meeting, isn't it, with the EU is the 21st this month, Theresa May. And I don't know what they're going to do then. Because it's funny how all the Remainers were saying they will not change that deal. They've said so many times they will not change the deal. So now she goes over there, they change the deal. Now Juncker's saying, we'll not give you a second chance, a third chance now. You've had a second chance. I think, do you know, when the pressure comes down to it, people do change, you know. Anyway.
They have to. It's an impasse. And let's not forget this works both ways. But I mean, we've had these debates before, but it's a two-way street here. You know, it's going to impact a bad Brexit or a no-deal Brexit would massively impact on the EU as well as the UK. So ultimately, I believe a deal will be done. And if not, the can will be kicked further down the road until a deal is done. So it's just posturing and brinkmanship right now. And I think everyone's just heartily sick of it. We want to get on with it. That's it.
Yep, that's it. Well, that's it. Do you know what? We should have a party launched. Me and you, just get on with it party. That's all it is. Just get on with it party. Stop whinging about things you can't change. Just get on with it. Exactly.
The crack on party, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Marvellous. Thanks. I'll catch up with you next week.
Thanks, Jess. Speak next week.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are as follows. At five, Red Ember Resources, RMP. At four, 88 Energy. That's ATD. At three, Rehobolt Resources, RBD. At two, Photon Star LED Group. That's PSL. And number one is Bacanora Lithium, BCN. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Arc Minerals, Directors Dealing. At four, Prospects Oil and Gas, Concession Enlargement and Production Update. At three, Botswana Copper Silver Plate, T3 Infill Drilling Results. I think that's for Metal Tiger. They never have their own company name in their RNS. At two, Sirius Minerals, Alternative Financing Proposal. Oh, I see. And at number one, Greatland Gold, US $65 million farming agreement with Newcrest at Havieron. That's one of their prospects, gold prospects. That's a good thing. There's also an article about that on Vox at voxmarkets.co.uk. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.